Hi, everyone. My name is Josh Nason, and this is Josh Nason's Punch Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. Welcome to the show, Wednesday, March 14th, 2018. Hope you guys are doing well as always. We survived probably about 15, 16 inches more snow here today. Yesterday, whatever day it is, we're ready for spring here in the Northeast, but we're looking forward to WrestleMania. We're looking forward to the path ahead, the road to WrestleMania, as it were. And part of that road, a little bit of divergence, is this Andre the Giant documentary that's coming out on HBO on April 10th. And I was lucky enough, skilled enough, amazing enough, not just kidding, thrilled to get the producer, director of this project, Jason Hare, on the show with me today. Jason stopped by for about 40 minutes or so. Really fun conversation. Jumped all over the place kind of in his career because he did a lot of work on combat sports stuff. So UFC Primetime did a ton of episodes there. Some of the most familiar ones, obviously Lesnar Velasquez, St. Pierre Hardy, you guys remember that one. Rampage Evans, and of course, the Velasquez Dos Santos series as well. It did all types of great stuff there. So we talked about that. We chatted about some of the 24/7 series that he's worked on for HBO. De La Hoya Mayweather, one of my favorites, which was Mayweather and Hatton. That was a fun one as well. And let's see, obviously 30 for 30. We didn't talk a ton about 30 for 30s just because we kind of want, there's only so much time. But obviously then we led into Andre the Giant coming out in just a couple weeks during WrestleMania week, April 10th. And, you know, just talked about that, how that thing came together and WWE's involvement, the comparisons between Dana White and Vince McMahon, because he's obviously talked to both. And this was a lot of fun. We jumped all over the map, but I think you guys are really going to enjoy this. So without further ado, let's get to the interview with the producer and director of Andre the Giant, Jason Hare. My guest this week is someone that anyone has watched sports documentaries and storytelling is intimately familiar with. He's produced and directs such ESPN work as the Fab Five, the 85 Bears, Down the Valley, and for fight fans, several unforgettable boxing countdown shows like De La Hoya Mayweather, De La Hoya Mayorga, Mayweather Hatton, as well as a run on UFC Primetime from 2010 to 2013. Work that's still revered today. In just a few short weeks, his latest work, an HBO documentary on Andre the Giant, will be released to the masses. This week on Josh Nason's Punch Out, we welcome Jason Hare to the show. And Jason, we'll start you out with a real fastball first, so get ready. You're from Newton, Mass. I am from New Hampshire. And I was wondering if for your next work, sometime in the future, maybe I can commission you to do a documentary about why Malcolm Butler didn't play in the Super Bowl this year. Do you think we could work on that?
I don't know if we'll get the clearance in Foxborough that we need to tell that story in its entirety, but I'm just as curious as you are about that one. And I'm also curious as to who would give Malcolm Butler $30 million guaranteed, but I'm happy for him and his story over the last 4 years is certainly worth a documentary that I would watch, but who knows what went down that week.
Yeah, very very bizarre stuff, and I don't know if you heard it. Nate Solder is also gone as well, signed with the New York Giants for 4 years and $60 million for a lineman, 60-60. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, it looks like the Pats have a little bit of regrouping to do, but they got Edelman coming back. Amendola left, but Edelman's coming back, and, you know, it's New England. You know this, man. The sky is always falling despite the fact that they are a modern-day dynasty. You know, my dad has given up and said, Rome has fallen and that's it. And, you know, they were a couple of plays from being Super Bowl champions. So we're spoiled. We're spoiled brats in New England. I'm the first one to admit that.
Certainly are. So you were out in LA. But you've been out there obviously for a while now. You still keep the New England roots with sports teams and kind of culture and all that.
I don't live in LA anymore. Out there for a brief period, from like 09 to 13, I was coming back and forth, but we were doing so much UFC work that I was spending more time in New York than I was in LA. So I was out there probably less than half the time for that stint. But otherwise, for the better part of the last 20 years, I've been in New York, and I get out to Boston as much as I can. So I'm still a diehard Sox, Pats, Celtics, Bruins fan.
Excellent. Great stuff. Well, you mentioned UFC, and that's where I wanted to start, kind of going over some of your past work. And I had first heard of you through Ariel Helwani, actually, had mentioned you quite a bit, and I believe you've been on his show before. And you guys, if I'm getting this right, you guys used to work together at Versus or Spike or something along those lines. Did I get that right?
Well, it started, Ariel was an intern at HBO when I was there.
Oh, that's
Ariel
right.
used to have an afro that he would have trouble getting in the door with. It was crazy what he looked like back in the day. But he was clearly a really, really sharp kid and just kind of a cut above the normal intern that comes in for the summer and hangs out. And he's also, as you know, just a great human being. So we got to be friends at HBO and we kept in touch. And then when I left HBO 10 years ago in May of 2008, and soon after that, the UFC called and wanted me to do some work with them. And the first guy that I called to work with me was Ariel, who at that point was not the Ariel Helwani that all MMA fans and sports fans now know. He was still, trying to work his magic and do his podcasts and get on air somehow. So he was actually my associate producer for the first UFC primetime that we did for the GSP BJ Penn fight.
Hmm. And it's interesting, you see guys like that. I'm sure there's other people in your life that have come along that are, you saw them kind of busting it and just really trying to make something of themselves. And then all of a sudden something happens, they get that big break and go with it. Was there something back then that really stood out to you? Is it just the work ethic or anything else notable that kind of helped him get where he is today?
He had a clear passion for the sport and for the culture. I remember that when I was at HBO, I was working among other shows on the Bob Costas show, which at that point was called On the Record. And Costas wanted to do a story. It was an old wrestling story about how wrestling in the South actually helped in the civil rights movement to break the color barrier, and how a lot of those old wrestlers were huge influencers in the civil rights movement. So I had mentioned to someone nearby that I needed to get in touch with, I think maybe it was Sam Martino or someone like that, who at that point, I had no other tools besides Google and, saying a prayer to get some contact info. And Ariel walked up with his cell phone and had all of the information of all of these classic, like Freddie Blassie and all these guys in his cell phone. And he told me that he had done a radio show in Syracuse and he kept in touch with these guys. And he had, Jerry Park at that point, I think, was his website. And I was just blown away by how thorough and professional he was. And he was just an intern, like logging tapes and going to get coffee for people. But it was clear from the get-go that this was a guy who was going to be a cut above.
Mm. So going back to your work on UFC Primetime, and these were, and I'm not just saying this because I'm talking to you, but these are works that people still remember now in terms of the storytelling aspects, just how they were shot. And what I really liked about them, and anyone that's familiar with your work, obviously this shouldn't be a surprise, but how you kind of looked at this stuff is not just two guys fighting. And typically, people have the people outside the MMA bubble have a perception of how MMA fighters are. And what I thought you really did well, and especially during the Dos Santos Velasquez one, definitely stands out, the one that led into Fox. You made these guys human, and you made these guys like that they have lives outside. And I remember talking to someone at the time saying, this is exactly what it needs to do. They're trying to reach the casual sports fan that may have this perception and try to humanize these guys and get them behind them and understand these guys have families just like everyone else and so on. As you were kind of looking at this series when you first started, you did all this great with, the GSP ones and on, what were did you see some challenges kind of with that going in that maybe there's perception and then actually what the reality was once you actually kind of get to know them?
Well, I was a good test case for that audience because I knew nothing about the UFC or MMA at the time. I think that Dana White had seen 24/7 and he's a huge boxing fan, obviously. And I think he liked the production value of those and he liked what it did for the pay-per-view financially, I'm sure. So he called after I left HBO interested in my working with them. And at first I was not interested at all because I was leaving HBO to get away from the fight promo game. I had done so many shows for them. I think it was 15 or 16 shows I had done within a couple of years for them. Trying to get people to pick up the phone and spend $50 to watch two guys beat the hell out of each other. And I was just kind of done with that.
Yeah.
But it was alluring to me because I knew nothing about the UFC, and I had the same misconceptions that everybody did at that point about what these guys were, what the sport was, and what kind of people populated that world. So when I studied a little bit more about they said that BJ and GSP was going to be the fight that they wanted to kick off primetime the series with. And when I looked a little bit more into it, it was like, you know, we can portray these guys kind of as they are and not have to embellish anything. I mean, GSP was kind of a man of the people at that point. He was living in a hotel with some of the guys in his fight crew. I mean, all these shows kind of blend together for me because it was so long ago. But I was just interested in the as always, in the story behind the mythology or the story behind the iconography of these guys. I'm always interested in demythologizing and de-iconizing these dudes, that kind of the way we did with Floyd back in the beginning and with Oscar, even just shooting these guys as if they were amateur fighters and hungry to win a title. So they agreed with that approach, and one thing led to another, and the next thing I know, I think we did like 13 or 14 of those series. It was crazy for about 4 years there. It just got to the point where, you know, we were doing one for every big fight. So, but I'm still, I mean, it was amicable. They don't do primetime anymore, I don't think. But I still keep in touch with those guys sometimes at the UFC.
It was out of all those personalities and that you dealt with then, I guess both in boxing and MMA, was there a few that really stood out? Obviously, I believe one of them was Brock Lesnar you worked with, obviously Floyd Mayweather, De La Hoya. I mean, you worked GSP, all these names. Was there one or a few that stood out? Were there moments that stood out during that run?
Dos Santos was great because he kind of was thrust into this world. I mean, he had, a couple of years before we covered him, he was destitute and he was a dishwasher, and just went into an MMA gym just to get into shape. So that was a really interesting story because he was really on the precipice of being a superstar at that point. It's always fun to cover people who are kind of on the brink like that. Floyd was Pretty Boy Floyd Mayweather when we started to cover him. He wasn't even Money Mayweather yet. I mean, he still had that kind of personality. He was still very mercurial, to put it mildly. And, you know, he, there were several challenges in covering Floyd. I think the first interview that we did with him on the original 24/7, I remember it was out by his pool in his, it was probably like three mansions ago. I don't know where Floyd lives now, but it was a nice house, but nowhere near what he's got now.
Yeah.
And we were supposed to shoot it at like 6 p.m. and we had it all lit to be sunset outside by his pool and all that. I think we started rolling the camera at like 2:30 in the morning because that's when he showed up at his house. We were sleeping in his backyard and he finally showed up. Mm-hmm. And we rolled the camera and we got this 2-hour interview that was like, there's moments in your career that are like game changers. We left that thing like, oh my God, the amount of stuff that we have here. Because that series was devised for Oscar to be the star. Floyd was the foil, but he was not supposed to be the star of that series. The reason why it was called De La Hoya Mayweather 24/7 and not 24/7 De La Hoya Mayweather is that they wanted Oscar's name to show up first in the guide when you're searching in the guide for what to watch, because Oscar's name was so famous at that point. They wanted to get women roped in. And so Oscar was supposed to be the star of that show, and Oscar is a nice guy, but he's nowhere near the TV character that Floyd is. So Floyd ended up stealing that entire show from episode one. We also had the benefit of probably the best time slot that I can think of in the last 10 years, at least, of programming, because we came on right after The Sopranos and Entourage on Sunday nights. And I still don't know how Ross Greenberg and the powers that be at that point pulled that off, because that was, I mean, Sunday night HBO is kind of the apex of peak TV. And all of a sudden we throw this boxing show on there. Our countdown shows have previously been shown after fights on Saturday nights, and the only people who watched them were boxing junkies. We did several countdown shows that were the same crews, the same shooters, the same editors, and I would like to say the same production value, except they were one episode, not four. But all of a sudden, now we're showing these things at 10:30 and the general public is starting to watch. So that was exciting to be able to show that to people who weren't boxing fans. Hmm.
With all these big personalities you've talked to and documented, and both in pro sports, traditional pro sports rather, and then obviously the fight game, and we'll get to Andre in a minute. Do you see a unifying characteristic or a personality trait with all of them that make them truly larger than life? Or something that you have seen along the way?
I'd like to go the opposite. Larger than life, I never buy that, and I think larger than life is kind of boring to watch. I'm always more interested in imperfections and insecurities in these guys. And you know, there's an old saying that a boxing trainer said once, that a boxing trainer that we covered, I forget who it was, but he said that you never show up at a boxing gym because your life is going perfectly. And so the common denominator with all of these guys is that something happened in their lives that got them into that gym and got them into that world. So whether it's Junior Dos Santos, who's making no money and is just trying to get in shape and goes to a local place, or it's Floyd, who grows up in poverty in Grand Rapids, or, you know, Oscar grew up in Whittier and he had a dad who kind of pushed him into the sport, but he wasn't that wealthy as a kid either. It's their background stories and just the environment of those gyms I still love. I mean, I still go to boxing gyms, to try to go like every other day, just because I love that environment. I'd much rather be there than at an Equinox or somewhere else. It's just a more authentic, real place for me. And those kind of people who populate those gyms fascinate me. So that's why I loved doing those shows, was just to be around in those environments and around those kind of people who were always either the champions themselves were still really hungry, but certainly the sparring partners and the up and comers and the younger kids in the gym. Those were the ones I was fascinated by, because they were in there just for the love of this. And they were living just about the most unglamorous life you can live. I mean, there's, name me a worse job than being a struggling fighter. You just going in to get your ass kicked every day. So I was always fascinated by what would compel someone to live that life.
Yeah, it's an addictive place when you go there. Yeah, boxing gyms, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, just any of these places you go. I think maybe it's because it's like the training ground, or I don't know what it is, but you're right. Maybe it's just the camaraderie and kind of people that have been there versus people that haven't. It's just, you're right. It is a thing where you go there and you just feel like it's a completely different world than any traditional gym that anyone can go to. And it's just, there's just something about it. That's a great point. I don't know why that is.
There's a palpable energy and a palpable respect, I think, for anyone who's in there participating, whether they're an amateur or a pro. If you come in there, it's not necessarily a fun place to be. I mean, it's a great place to let off some steam, but it's not. There's no, you know, eucalyptus towels and fancy, you know, spin classes and things like that would be in some of the more modern gyms. You go in there and it's all just, it's brick and wood and sweat and heat and loud music, and it's everything primal and visceral that I love about, activity. So, and everyone in there, you know, if you're actually throwing on gloves and you're getting in the ring, if you're sparring and doing that, then you automatically gain some respect, because it's not an easy thing to do. It's we're hardwired not to want that experience, to be afraid of that experience. So anyone who participates in that automatically gets some respect. So you would think, I thought before this, I got into that world with production, that it would be a very macho kind of a bullying place, but it's just the opposite. It's way more respectful and way more welcoming than some of the other athletic venues or arenas that I've been in.
So let's pivot to Andre the Giant. Obviously, the documentary coming out on HBO here in a few weeks. When did you first get approached with the concept of doing something? And at what point during the discussions did it really kind of like get its hooks into you to be like, I gotta do this next?
I think it was as much as 2 years ago, thereabouts, that Bill Simmons, who I had worked with on 30 for 30 stuff, you know, we didn't really work that closely together. He would be kind of the last round of notes he would chime in, because at that point he had a million different irons in the fire, and I think they were launching Grantland at the time that I started to work on 30 for 30s, but he and I were certainly familiar with each other. And Peter Nelson, who's now the president of HBO Sports, on the first UFC primetime, so he said Ariel was my AP, my associate producer. Peter Nelson was the writer of the first UFC primetime.
Oh, wow.
And he and I are from the same hometown. Peter's about 5 years younger than me, but we have a lot of common friends and common hangouts and haunts and stuff. So Peter and I have been friends for, you know, over a decade. So when he called and said that Bill was interested in doing this Andre story, and then Bill called, I was hesitant at first because I'm not a pro wrestling fan. I didn't grow up in that environment. I wasn't one of those kids who was hooked on early. But I was certainly interested in the truth behind the mythology of this character, of this guy, and kind of sussing out what was fact and what was fiction about this guy who was an icon from my childhood. Like I said, I wasn't a huge wrestling fan, but I certainly knew who Andre the Giant was. I had seen some of the WrestleManias, and he was just such a pop culture fixture for an 8, 9, 10-year-old at that point that I knew exactly who he was. So it took a little bit of my digging in to see, you know, what his background was. I'll tell you how ignorant I was to his story at the beginning of this thing. When we started doing the budget, we budgeted to go to Grenoble, which is where he's, you know, supposedly from, in the French Alps, which is about 6 hours south of Paris. So we're thinking, how are we going to get all the gear from this place? Because I heard that he lived in Paris. Once he started wrestling, he was in Paris. And I was like, oh, that would be interesting to figure out, you know, what brought him a 6 hour plane flight north to this place, or bus ride, whatever it was, I forget. And then pretty soon we realized that that was all BS, that he was never from the Alps, and that was just this alter ego that they had created for him as his character, because we didn't get to say it. We cut a lot of stuff out of the doc, but the reason they chose Grenoble is because the Olympics, the Winter Olympics were there back in the 60s. So that was a town that people in North America would immediately recognize as a place in the French Alps. So that was convenient for the storyline that they wanted to build, the backstory they wanted to build for this guy. But in reality, he was just from a half hour outside of Paris in this tiny little village called Molien.
Perfect transition. My next question. So with this whole world of wrestling, and you mentioned that you weren't really a big fan growing up, but obviously you were kind of aware, I guess, you know, pop culture wise. We're just about the same age. I'm 40. You're what, 41? So it kind of came through the 80s and kind of the whole rock and wrestling boom and Hogan and Andre and some of those characters there. So in the movie with Mickey Rourke, the Wrestler came out, I think kind of the world kind of got a view of a different form of what, or just kind of how weird wrestling is, and especially on the indie level. And I'm sure a lot of people thought stuff was made up in there, which actually wasn't. As you kind of delved into this world of professional wrestling, I guess for not even a newcomer to this, what were you just like amazed at how weird and strange a business as this actually is?
Well, it's kind of a distant cousin of MMA and boxing in that fight world. So I was familiar with the passion of the fans and these niche figures and niche attractions and niche venues and niche promotions. I was familiar with that. It wasn't like going from the NFL to the WWE or WWF back in Andre's day. But yeah, that was actually part of the allure, was that this world was populated by these larger than life characters who had real names. I was less interested in Hulk Hogan than I was in Terry Bollea, where he's from and what brought him to where he was. And luckily those guys, you know, one of the things I thought would be a hurdle is convincing Vince McMahon and all the higher ups at WWE to let me tell this story in a real way and not have to, you know, pretend that all of this stuff was not scripted and staged. And it was never even a discussion. We never even got that far in the discussion. The meeting that I had with Vince, you know, he was already very open about how the planning for WrestleMania 3 evolved and all of that. So I never had to have that discussion that I had rehearsed in my head. You know, it's so important for us to tell the true story, because truth be told, I wouldn't have done it if they had made me adhere to kind of the fiction of this thing and not say who these guys really were. I wouldn't have done it, but it was never even a discussion. And that's, you know, I say that, as a compliment to them, that they wanted to tell the true story of these guys.
So there was no, cause I know that there was a lot of skepticism early on, like how much, obviously it was cool that WWE let, you know, essentially was a partner with you in laying the footage, and the footage is such an important part, as you know, but they were like completely cool, like to tell the story and didn't have any restrictions or anything like that.
I came in with a list of people that I wanted to interview for this thing, including Andre's daughter and people that I thought, you know, may kind of cause Vince to raise his eyebrow. And there wasn't one person that he even blinked at. He said, however you want to tell this story, we trust you. We hired you for a reason, and we want you to tell the story as you want to tell it. But his whole thing was to tell the true, honest, authentic story of this guy. So that was kind of the reins were off at that point. I mean, this was still, we were still in discussion phase at this point. But when you asked before, you know, what was that moment where it clicked and you said, I really want to do this? I think it was after that meeting with Vince where he said, you know, we want you to tell the story however you want to tell it. And then with Bill Simmons, I knew what a rabid wrestling fan he was. And my reluctance with him is that I was afraid that he was going to want to cover some of the minutiae of wrestling more than just, you know, the story of the humans, rather than like, well, we have to talk about the match against the Samoans in 1976 at the Garden, like that kind of stuff, which I really didn't want to get into. I knew we were going to really delve into the WrestleMania 3 match because that was so pivotal to the story of he and Hogan. And, you know, one of the major stories is the through line of their friendship throughout this thing. But Bill was in complete agreement with me on that. And our sensibilities just kind of aesthetically are the same. And then we both agreed that the B story here was going to be the evolution of pro wrestling from the 60s up and, you know, through until the 90s, and how that evolved, how the territorial system evolved into the WWF takeover and cable TV and syndication. I was really fascinated by that on a business level. And Bill agreed with that approach. So everything just kind of melded together. Once I met with Vince and once he was cool with the approach that we wanted to take, then it was a done deal.
From conception to execution, what did you find that your biggest challenge was?
Well, we only had, you know, a certain amount of time to tell these things. And as with any story, you could tell it for 3 hours, you could tell it in 10 minutes. It's just a question of how many details you go into. With Andre, there's so much mythology, and there are so many stories out there about him that people have heard. The challenge was, do we go down these rabbit holes that we know are false? So, for instance, this Samuel Beckett story that everybody tells. For the listeners out there who aren't familiar with it, and knowing this podcast, probably everybody's familiar with it, but the rank-and-file people who don't know wrestling that well are not. So there's a story out there that Samuel Beckett lived near Andre's family when he was younger, and that Andre, by the time he was 12, was too big to ride the bus. And as a favor to the family, Samuel Beckett would drive Andre in his truck to school, and that they developed this bond, this friendship, this unlikely friendship of this, you know, famous Irish playwright and this future wrestling titan. All of it is false. Samuel Beckett lived in that neighborhood. That is true. And he did drive a truck. That is true. There was no bus to the school. The school was a mile away, and all the kids from the village that Andre grew up in, including his siblings, would walk to that school every morning. So if Beckett saw them along the road, he would let them hop into the back of his truck, and he would drive all the kids into town. Part of that story is that Andre got too big for school, and by the time he was 13, had to drop out of school because he was too big to fit in the desk and all that. All the kids back in rural France in those days left school by the time they were 13 or 14. It wasn't an option. That's when school ended. You went to work as a laborer, or you went on to university in a few years. But so this whole mythology, now what I just told you took a couple of minutes. Do we want to waste those couple of minutes to lead viewers down a rabbit hole just to tell them, well, this is false? Or do we just want to say that we're going to be the definitive doc about this guy's life, and if it's not in there, then it didn't happen? That still is a challenge to me, because I know that I can see the reviews now that are going to come out and say, well, they didn't mention this, and they didn't mention that he once drank 156 beers. The rule was, for us going in, only first-person accounts. So, okay, I heard Andre drank 156 beers. Were you there? No. Okay, then it's not going to go on the doc. Ric Flair says he drank 106 beers in front of me, 106. That went in the doc because Ric Flair is saying that. Now, it's on Ric if he's lying. Ric Flair would never lie, right?
Right, right.
It's on him if he's lying, but we decided that at least we're going to give ourselves a fighting chance here to be an authentic story and let these people tell it in the first person. There is no hearsay here. It's all first-person accounts.
Did you?
We asked his brother. We asked Andre's brother about that Samuel Beckett story, and he was dumbfounded. Hmm. He laughed. He had never heard that legend about him. I mean, these are guys who still live in rural France. But he said, no, Mr. Beckett lived in the neighborhood, and he would pick us up sometimes if it was raining or something, and he was driving by, but he had no special relationship with Andre.
Speaking of Flair, did you see the Flair 30 for 30?
I did.
What did you think?
It was good. I mean, you know what, man? The footage, anytime you show any footage from that era, it's going to be entertaining. You really could show. We had 1,000 hours of footage that we went through for this, and you had mentioned before how cooperative the WWE was, and I can't say enough about George DeMarnikos and all of the people in their library who were just bent over backwards for a year for us anytime we needed a piece of footage. So we could have gone wall-to-wall with this thing and just showed B-roll after B-roll of Andre and Flair and all those guys. So, yeah, anytime you show any character from that era, it's going to be really entertaining. And Flair, obviously, is made for TV, and there may not be a more charismatic character anywhere in professional sports, entertainment.
And you mentioned you can already kind of see the reviews of this from wrestling fans now. I mean, wrestling fans are obviously, they were very interested in that Flair 30 for 30 doc. And, of course, everyone was like, we'd like to see this, or, you know, how do you fit this into an hour and a half, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, you certainly have your work cut out for you with trying to appease everyone, but it's impossible, right? I mean, everyone's going to have something to say about something, right?
It's always the fans who are the most rabid and the most passionate and know the most who are the most critical, because they're the ones who are going to get bored the most easily if you're telling the basics. But I try and you know, do my best to appease them and to keep them interested, and hopefully that footage and the photos that we dug up are rare enough that they're going to be their attention will be held throughout this thing, and some of the interviews that we've done hopefully will hold their attention. But also you have to cater to the casual fan. And really what we do when we make these things is just try and entertain ourselves in the edit room. If it's myself and my producers and my editors and everyone there is liking what it is, then we just kind of cross our fingers and hope that the rest of the world likes it too. But if you start to produce something for a certain audience, then, you know, you're just trying to avoid criticism or get praise, and that's the wrong way to go about these things. So we just try to make something that we like that fits our taste, and then hope that everybody else likes it as well.
A couple more questions, and we'll wrap it up. Hulk Hogan, you mentioned, obviously he's a big part of this. We see him in some of the trailers so far. And what was your impressions coming off your interviews with him?
He gave us over 3 hours. I really, you know, I know his history, and I know that the recent controversy with him. So I can't speak to that. I do know that he couldn't have been nicer to our crew and more generous with his time. I had no idea that he and Andre were as close as they were. Even in our research, you know, we knew that they were friends, but after 3 hours, it was clear just how much affection he had for this guy and how much admiration he has for him. So he was probably the MVP of this doc in terms of the stories that he provided, the detail he provided, the candor with which he provided those details. So I really can't say enough about how much he helped us out and how generous he was with his time. And he also, I don't want to give too much away. Have you seen the doc?
I haven't seen it yet, no.
I don't want to give too much away, but he recreated a couple of key pieces of memorabilia that we needed to tell a couple of stories. And he was just really generous and cooperative with us. And I didn't know, you know, going into it, you don't know. These are world famous people, and sometimes they're over it. Sometimes they're too big for these kind of things, and they'll give you a half hour and split. But he really could not have been more generous with us. So my experience with him was, I would call it an A+.
Did he happen just to, you know, pitch his own documentary somewhere along the way?
No, there was none of that. You know, he came in and he was a little bit sheepish because he had like a little makeup bag with him. He had to go in and touch himself up before he got on camera. And, you know, he got along with our guys pretty well. We have a really tight knit group. So when people come in to be interviewed, they can tell immediately that it's just, you know, you're among a bunch of guys who are friends and have done this before. So you could tell at the beginning, he was a little bit reluctant, because he didn't know. I think once he saw what the questions were and what the line of questioning was and where I was trying to go with the story, he loosened up more and more. But at the beginning, he doesn't know me. He has no idea what kind of story I'm trying to tell, or if I've been sent here by Vince, if I've been sent here against Vince's wishes. He has no idea. I'm sure he's got a thousand things running through his head, but he could not have been more cooperative that day with us. He was one of our first interviews. We interviewed Vince, it might be a year to the day, like March, I want to say like March 15th or 16th or something. Today's the 14th, a year ago. And then a couple of weeks later, Masters weekend, I remember, I went down to Florida and we hit five cities in 5 days and interviewed Tim White, Hulk, Mean Gene, Pat Patterson, and a guy named Harris Yett, who was the doctor who did the surgery on Andre's ankle back in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. And we did those five interviews in 5 days. We did a big circle around the center of Florida and ended up where we started in Orlando and went all the way, you know, down the West Coast and then across Alligator Alley over to Fort Lauderdale and interviewed Patterson and came all the way back up. So Hulk was the second or third interview that we did. So once we had we had a great interview with Vince and a great one with Hulk, and we knew that we were off and running at that point.
Excellent. And finally, so Dana White and Vince McMahon, two guys you've talked to quite a bit, obviously for this project, but then obviously UFC primetime for Dana. What, you know, a lot of people say there's similarities between them, and some people see some differences, but that at heart they seem to be, you know, very, very similar. Did you come off those impressions as well?
My dealings with Vince, I mean, I've heard the stories about Vince back in the day, but my dealings with him is that he was a very reserved guy. He was almost solemn at points, you know, spoke very quietly, very respectful and very nice to the crew and everything, but he was very soft-spoken. Dana comes in and it's a hurricane. It's like a typhoon in the room. When Dana's in the room, you know he's in the room. Vince was a lot more soft-spoken and just, you know, Dana comes in jeans and a t-shirt and he's dropping F-bombs all over the place. And Vince comes in a $4,000 tailored suit. And he's, you know, he sits down and gets his makeup done. And, he had a very kind of, relaxed way about him, but he was in control the whole time. It was a very kind of a rigid standard interview with Dana. You never know where he's going to go, and he's hopping out of the frame. He's standing up, he's taking phone calls. So, I can see how professionally Vince was probably a role model for Dana, just in terms of the empire that he built. But in terms of personality, they were quite different.
And final question, out of your whole profile of stuff you've worked on, there is one that stands out, I'd say, more than any other, more than anything we've talked about. I'm not talking about the Fab Five or, you know, anything like that. You worked on a Michael Bublé, I believe, live from Madison Square Garden, if I have the title right. You have all these fighters, all these, you know, classics, 30 for 30s. But you have this concert film that stands out. How did that happen? And you have not done, I don't believe you've done a concert film since.
I would love to. What happened was that when I left HBO, I got a call from Bublé's manager and a guy named Bruce Allen. And he said that Michael had watched Mayweather Hatton 24/7 and loved it and wanted to do something like that for himself. And I said, I don't understand. Is he going to fight Harry Connick? Like, what's going on here? How are we going to do a countdown to a Michael Bublé thing? And it was really what he was saying was that he wanted that, you know, that kind of that camera look, that production quality, that kind of, you know, edited, whatever made 24/7 what it was. He liked that, and he didn't want to do a standard concert film for his next film. He wanted to do something that was a little more behind the scenes. So we spent a week with him. I cannot say enough good about the guy. I had a fantastic time with him. I bumped into him a couple of times since, and you know, we kind of like gave each other hugs. We had a great time with each other that week, but it was a week in his life leading up to his first show at Madison Square Garden. We went back to the first little tiny club that he played in New York and talked to him about his family. He had just met the woman who's now his wife. He had just met her. So he was telling me about this beautiful Argentinian, I think she's from Argentina, South American woman that he was considering, like, you know, do I go down and see her or what? And, you know, now they have two kids. And yeah, that was a great experience. I'm a huge sports and music have been my two passions since I could walk. So I would love to get back in the music game. It's come close a couple of times, and we'll see. But, you know, I really hope that someday I get to do more music documentary, music films, because that's also where my passions lie.
Well, usually at this time we ask people to kind of plug social media and different stuff they're working on, but obviously we know what's happening. April 10th, Andre the Giant comes out on HBO, but I did want to ask you if there's any work that you, other stuff you want to plug coming out of your studio, coming up, or, friends of yours, and maybe that has put some stuff together that people should watch, or charities or anything like that. Well, you know, you've been in this world of pro wrestling. We'll throw the mic to you and let you do a promo. Floor is yours.
I wish I had the talent that some of these wrestlers have to do a wrestling promo, but I nothing of that I'm at liberty to talk about now with future projects. And then, As far as friends go, you know, I could give you a list of documentaries and things to watch, but yeah, maybe another time if I get a little bit more prep. I'm sure these guys know when they're about to give a promo, so I'm not at that level yet where I can do it off the cuff. But yeah, April 10th, 10 o'clock Tuesday night, Andre the Giant, HBO. Watch it. Hope people love it.
And I will tell people that coming out, I'll do a plug for you. In February of 2025, Jason Hare's new documentary, Did the Butler Do It? The story of the 2017-18 New England Patriots will come out. So we'll do that promo now, and you guys can get a jump on it, hopefully figure everything out.
It'll be right when Tom Brady is becoming the first 52-year-old to repeat as Super Bowl champion.
What did you think? Have you seen Tom versus Time yet?
Yeah, I loved it. I thought they did a great job with it.
I did too.
It was really, I was expecting it to be just kind of like a standard, you know, celebrity, is this real or is it not? But I thought they did a really good job with it. And, you know, hats off to him, because that takes a lot to actually let someone into your life like that and really show what things are really like. So the access that he gave that crew and the trust that he clearly had in Gotham Chopra and everybody else on that crew, I thought it was outstanding.
Yep, I would agree. I would agree. Jason Hare, thanks so much.
You got it.
All right. Big thanks to Jason Hare for stopping by. You can follow him on Twitter. He's not a super active socialite, considering his last tweet was on December 2017. Let's see. Jason M. Hare, H-E-H-I-R. Good Boston guy, good New England guy, and happy to support him. And obviously this, very much looking forward to this documentary. And I think a lot of people are going to enjoy it. I have not seen it yet, as I mentioned during the show. Dave and Brian, some other people have, so I'll be watching it along with you guys as well. Let's see, other stuff coming up in combat sports. No UFC last weekend. However, we do have a show coming up this Saturday, I think that's right. List of UFC events here. Let's go. This is Verdum. This is the O2 Arena in London, England. I believe this is on Saturday. This is the 17th. Coming up, this is headlined by Fabricio Verdum and Alexander Volkov. Heavyweight main event, Jimmy Manuwa and John Blachowicz in the co-main, I guess you would call it there. This is a Fight Pass only show, no big surprise. There is a lot of nothing on this show, to be completely honest with you guys. Not a lot of buzz coming into this. I think Tom Dukinwah at bantamweight, I think it's kind of interesting to see where he comes out on the show. I feel like, so Peter Sabata's fighting on the show. I feel like he fights on every single European show, but there's a lot of European guys on here. Not a ton on here that I'm seeing kind of buzzworthy stuff. I think obviously the heavyweight fight, you know, who knows? Anyone could get a title shot now, it appears, or get in line with a title shot in the heavyweight division. So Verdum, Volkov, you know, they're kind of positioning, jockeying themselves maybe for something bigger this year. For some reason, something happens with the Miocic Cormier fight. Same thing with light heavyweight, honestly. Jimmy Manuwa and John Blachowicz, or Jan Blachowicz, rather, and then Tom Dukinwah as well. Prospect at 135, and I believe he's coming off his first loss, if I have that right. And first loss in UFC, and he's only fought twice in UFC, but there's a lot of buzz behind him, and he's going to be looking to kind of pick things back up after a split decision loss in his last fight as well. So without further ado, I'm just going to get out of here. Big thanks to Jason Hare for stopping by. Thanks to all you guys for listening. You have a lot of choices in your podcast day, and I appreciate you spending any time with us or with any other great podcast here on WrestlingObserver.com. So I wish you a great weekend, and we'll be back with a brand new episode probably on Monday or Tuesday of next week. So until next time, this has been Josh Nace's Punch-Out. Insert catchphrase here.